The second case for oral argument this morning is Tonya A. Reef versus Dwayne Russell Warden. For the appellant, Tonya Reef is Susan Shea Bruger, an attorney from Pierre, and for the appellee, Dwayne Russell is Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general, also from Pierre. Ms. Bruger, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. As the court has already noted, my name is Susan Shea Bruger. I represent Tonya Reef in her appeal of a denial of a writ of habeas corpus. This is a case that is appealed out of the Third Circuit. Tonya was convicted of attempted first-degree murder. She entered a plea and pleading guilty but mentally ill. She was sentenced to 20 years. All this occurred in the year 2000. Basically, there are three issues that are presented in some subparts of at least one of them. That is ineffective assistance of counsel, prosecutorial misconduct, and cruel and unusual sentencing. The standard of review is clearly erroneous. In looking at an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, this court looks at Strickland versus Washington primarily, and that is whether or not trial counsel committed such serious errors that counsel was not functioning as counsel guaranteed by the Constitution, and that the error or errors prejudiced her to the point of being deprived of a fair trial. What we are alleging today as our primary issue under the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is that her trial counsel failed to correctly advise her of her federal liability in this matter. As a result, Ms. Reef entered a plea of guilty but mentally ill, with the understanding that under the Pettit policy, she may very well also incur federal liability for the crimes of which she was accused. Under federal liability, she was looking at 30 years or more instead of our maximum in the case of an attempted murder of 25 years. So as a result, she felt coerced to enter a plea of guilty but mentally ill.
But Ms. Bruger, as I understand the record, she received the Pettit letter before sentencing and yet elected to proceed with a plea of guilty and be sentenced. Having read the Pettit letter and no understanding that there wasn't going to be a federal prosecution.
That is correct, and it was just before sentencing. I think there she received the letter or her counsel received the letter by fax on the 12th.
Well, how can you say that the plea isn't knowing and voluntary if you received that information before the sentence is handed down and you elect to proceed?
I believe she felt coerced into proceeding because of the fact that she'd already entered her plea and that there was such a short amount of time between the receipt of the letter, which I believe was September 12th, and her sentencing date, which was the very next day. She was not advised fully as to how she could withdraw her plea. I saw nothing in the record which would indicate that her counsel went to her and said, okay, are we withdrawing this plea?
Is there any testimony by her in affidavit form or in testimony that that's the case? I mean, we can't just go at suppositions. There's got to be some hard evidence that might possibly be the case.
To be honest, it's only alluded to in the record of the habeas hearing.
It's what?
It's alluded to in the
what
record
that,
of the habeas
what does that mean?
It means that it was covered, but
was there
not
testimony by her or not?
She didn't directly say that she felt coerced to continue with her plea. But she discussed, as I recall, that her that she felt she had to go forward. I think it's important to note that a little bit about the Pettit policy, which was a policy developed by the U.S. Justice Department after a case in 1960, a U.S. Supreme Court case, U.S. versus Pettit. One of the concerns with the Pettit doctrine is that there is no question of double jeopardy when dealing with dual sovereigns. The Pettit case itself dealt with successive prosecutions for essentially the same crime. As a result, the U.S. Justice Department developed the Pettit Doctrine more or less as a public service or a public relations type of thing, so that there wasn't the so that there was a policy in place that the U.S. Justice Department needed to go through before doing before prosecuting someone who has already been prosecuted by the state. We feel that her trial counsel failed to fully investigate the Pettit policy at the time that all this was occurring. It was about the time of the case here in Pierre involving Mr. Waldman, who was later prosecuted by the federal government as well. I think there was a concern at the time among defense counsel that that would happen in cases that they had as well. I think something, a case such as this one, which was attempted first degree murder, but was essentially an attempted murder for hire. I think there's a concern that when there's a crime such as that that's being charged, that the federal government would also be interested because of the concern that organized crime might be involved. Simply by looking at the internet and doing a simple search, her trial counsel could have discovered that this is really a very difficult process for the U.S. Justice Department to go through. It's just not something that a U.S. attorney decides, well, we're going to prosecute this one and go ahead and does it. They have to get an okay from Washington as to going forward. There has to be a hearing as to whether or not there really is a double jeopardy concern. All of these things could have been discussed with Tanya prior to even doing a change of plea, so that she could have done a knowing and voluntary decision as to entering a guilty plea.
In the findings of fact, the court does make a finding of fact that that she was given the opportunity by her counsel to request to withdraw her guilty but mentally ill plea. Are you saying there's not evidence in the record to support that finding? Finding 8 is what I'm looking at.
And it is, in fact, part of the plea agreement that should that she would be allowed to withdraw her plea. Nevertheless, she felt that herself that she couldn't due to the short amount of time between receiving the letter from the U.S. Attorney's Office and being sentenced.
Well, Ms. Berger, if we were to set aside a plea in a case like this under these facts, we have a written plea agreement that allows withdrawal of the plea. And you get the letter, you get the information, and you elect to proceed. We would never have any finality in any kind of a plea, would we? I mean, should we reverse in a case like this? That precedent would allow anybody anytime to change their mind, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. But if the court would adopt a rule similar to what is looked into with a coerced confession, wherein we're looking at the defendant's age, we're looking at their education and level of intelligence, we're looking at whether or not they were on the influence of drugs or alcohol or medication, and additionally looking at their mental state. I think if we were to adopt a rule whereas we were looking at a coerced plea, so to speak, under a totality of circumstances, that would narrow the times that someone could claim that their plea was coerced. I think in Tanya's case, she was certainly not a juvenile, but she was a young person. She'd never been charged with a crime. I couldn't even find that she'd ever even gotten a parking ticket. Even though she was a legal secretary, even though she'd been a dispatcher in the sheriff's office in Dual County, I don't think in dealing with the people that I deal with that she had an excellent grasp of just how the criminal justice system works, given as well her mental state. First of all, never having been charged with a crime, she was someone who ended up pleading guilty but mentally ill, and certainly the state had no problem with allowing her to do that. There's a letter in the record from her treating psychiatrist as to the problems that she had with mental illness. I think if you look at everything under a totality of circumstances, I think in that case, that would be a situation where they could be allowed to, where this court could overturn her guilty plea.
Are there other factors then that you're basing the ineffective assistance of counsel besides the one you've just discussed?
Yes, there is. Another way in which she wasn't able to make a knowing and intelligent plea is that her trial counsel failed to investigate fully Joe Campbell, who is the person that put her in contact with the fictitious hitman. Her trial counsel, I believe in his testimony at the habeas hearing, made the comment that after his interview with Mr. Campbell, he felt that he was untrustworthy at best, even though he tried through an investigator to find out a little bit more about him. The investigator he hired was not able to uncover very much.
Have you gone out now and uncovered a lot of stuff against Joe Campbell?
No, I have not. I haven't even made the attempt.
Isn't that an element of proof in order to get to show prejudice, in order to show ineffective assistance to counsel?
It could be.
Could be.
However, I think given the track record that was in the habeas hearing as to
what if there's nothing there to be found? What if there's nothing there to be found? How have you shown that there's any prejudice whatsoever? I mean, you have to prove prejudice in order to establish ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland versus Washington, don't you?
Yes, that's true.
All right. So what if there's nothing to be found and you have not shown anything, then you've not proven prejudice, slam dunk, over and done with, isn't it?
Not necessarily. I think there are other issues wherein this court would decide that that was not part of it. I think there's enough under the other issues under ineffective assistance of counsel.
I'm just talking about this one issue at a time. Okay. What other issues do you have? What other grounds for ineffective assistance of counsel do you have where you've shown prejudice?
Other than the first one I discussed, her trial counsel's failure to file a motion to suppress her confession. And again, in talking about whether or not her confession was coerced, admittedly, she did sign the Miranda waiver. However, she doesn't recall signing the Miranda waiver. I think we need to look at her mental state at the time. I've already discussed, while she wasn't a juvenile, she was certainly very young, very inexperienced with being on that side of the criminal justice system. She's also someone that is easily pushed into situations. I think is this evidenced by how she got involved in the allegations for which she was ultimately convicted.
Somebody pushed her into trying to kill her ex-husband?
Yes, we believe so. But
you know, your belief that that's so, once again, isn't enough. I mean, you have to have some proof of that. You have to show that.
I understand that, and naturally, having taken over this case from someone who actually did the habeas hearing, I'm rather stuck with the record as it stands.
Can you talk about the cruel and unusual punishment issue?
Yes. As this court is well aware, what we need to look at is the conduct involved, the relevant past conduct, and then if it looks like there's gross disproportionality, then we look at an inter and intra jurisdictional analysis, and ultimately the effect upon society for this kind of offense.
In this case, however, she did not receive the maximum, which we normally not found that to be cruel and unusual. What's different about this case?
I think in part that in looking at the conduct involved and the record as it stood as sentencing, that particularly since it involved a fictitious hitman and no one was ultimately injured and...
Still, isn't this... attempted first-degree murder, that's attempting to kill another human being, is probably one of the most serious crimes in the books, isn't it? I don't mean to make light of other felonies, but I can't think of another felony that's more serious.
Other than murder itself.
Right.
I agree. But I think and perhaps I'm looking at it more literally and looking at the actual conduct that was involved in committing the crimes is what I was primarily looking at. I think also in looking at the relevant past conduct, that this is nothing that she didn't come close to committing in the past. She has no criminal record. And as I mentioned before, I couldn't even find that she had a parking ticket. In looking at the inter and intra-jurisdictional analysis, to be honest, I couldn't find that anything too recently that was even a similar charge to compare it to. Um, I guess that's all I have on the...
Very well.
If there's something else, I would ask that you reverse Judge Martin's denial of her writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Ann Meyer, and I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the respondent. This defense attorney, like any other defense attorney, had the same quandary. He needed to decide what to rule in and what to rule out. He wanted to rule out the federal charges because they'd come up during discussion with the state's attorney. He had talked about this with several public defenders. He did research on it. He went back to his client. He talked to her about it. I've never seen this standard incorporated for totality of circumstances where you have to show that somebody is like doing a confession, and we would oppose adopting that kind of standard. The standard for habeas is whether there's been a gross error in recommending the plea. This defense attorney ruled out any federal charges because he wanted to make sure his client wouldn't face that on down the road and that he wouldn't be sitting in a habeas prosecution or hearing where he thought that someone would say to him, why didn't you rule that out?
Had these federal charges been pursued in a sentence entered, was there a potential consecutive sentence with the state charge?
He mentions in the habeas record that he found a statute. He doesn't identify the statute. It's not in the record, but our research shows that there's a racketeering statute and that that conspiracy is 10 years if you're trying to import an assassin from another state. It's 20 if you hurt someone, and it's life or death if you kill somebody. So I don't know where she gets the 30. There was no testimony from habeas counsel that there was a 30-year sentence pending in some kind of federal prosecution. Nevertheless,
the federal sentencing could have exceeded, even if concurrent, the potential sentence she was looking at in the state court.
Possibly. Right. But there were no guarantees what she'd get in state court, and she was asking for perpetual probation. So I don't think for him to have made that kind of estimation, there isn't anything in the record that says that. And I want to pick up on Justice Saber's comment. There is testimony in the record. Judge Martin asked her during the habeas hearing, did you understand that you could withdraw your plea with respect to any federal charges being filed? She said, I understood that. She knew that she could withdraw it. She didn't do that at the sentencing hearing. Her counsel was there with her. He said he met with her at the jail. They discussed the letter that came in from Ridgeway, and they decided that he said, do you want to withdraw your plea a couple times? And she said, no, I don't want to go to trial. So he left it at that. And I want to talk for a minute about Joe Campbell. The petitioner has the burden on habeas to show that there's something out there favorable or material to their case. They used a Minnesota investigator to check background on this individual. They didn't find anything other than another Joe Campbell in the same Watertown area, and it's not the same Joe Campbell. You can't stand here and say there's something theoretically out there that would have made a difference in this case. The state's attorney didn't turn anything over, and so the defense counsel logically concluded that there wasn't anything out here. There wasn't any impeachment evidence that he could use to show that Joe Campbell had a crime in his background. And that's why there certainly isn't any prosecutorial misconduct, and they certainly haven't met their burden, as Judge Martin concluded. On the suppression hearing, which counsel talked about for our suppression motion, defense counsel testified during the habeas hearing that the suppression hearing or a suppression motion would have been futile in this case because there was no legal basis for it. The petitioner signed a Miranda waiver. That's part of the habeas exhibits. She also was interviewed at a detention center, and they had the videotape from that. He didn't find anything in doing his research that showed that a suppression motion would stand. And if there are no further questions, we'll conclude. We'd ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Ms. Brewer, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I'll simply address a few of the parts of Ms. Meyer's argument. Going back to Joe Campbell, Ms. Meyer noted that the state's attorney didn't turn anything over. And that was one of the other issues regarding prosecutorial misconduct. even though it was court-ordered, there is nothing in the record, first of all, that they turned over any criminal record or that there was any pursuit of obtaining any criminal record. To be honest, I don't know of a state's of a defense attorney who does not nag a little bit about any potential witnesses for the purposes of impeachment, should there be a felony or should there be a crime of any untrustworthiness for impeachment purposes. I think in making the decision to seek a plea rather than go to trial, I think that's one of the important things you need to look at. And I don't believe trial counsel looked at just how strong the state's civil witnesses were or non-law enforcement witnesses were. I think that's sort of a two-headed issue in that the state didn't turn anything over. There's nothing that said that they didn't have anything, and trial counsel simply did not pursue it. As to chasing down any federal liability and eliminating that prior to entering a plea for concerns of a habeas hearing later on, well, he certainly didn't avoid a habeas. Really, there is not that great of a threat of federal liability, even for the conspiracy and the racketeering charges that she could have possibly been liable for in federal court. As I mentioned in my argument, it's a very difficult procedure that the U.S. Justice Department and the U.S. attorneys have to go through in order to bring those federal charges. In preparing for my argument, I spoke with the Assistant United States Attorney that had done the Waldman case in federal court, and he said to his knowledge it's very rare that that's been done in this state, and to his knowledge that was the only time that they invoked the Pettit policy and went through the procedure here in South Dakota in probably the past 5 or 10 years. It's the federal liability for Ms. Tanya Reef is, it was there to a limited extent, but simply by doing a little additional research and investigation, I think trial counsel would have been confident that that was not something she really needed to worry about to the extent that it was brought up and held over her head during the plea negotiations. As I stated earlier, I would encourage the court to adopt a rule of looking at the totality of circumstances in determining if a plea is coerced. And I will conclude and thank you for your time and urge you to listen to the writ. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will be in recess until 11 o'clock.